Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Yale School of Medicine forensic psychiatrist Dr. Brandi X. Lee evidently was interviewed recently, and she said that Donald Trump has, quote, failed every criterion of basic mental capacity evaluation. He's failed everything. And as I read it, I'm going, well, about time, Brandi. Welcome to the club. Thanks for being here. Good for you. I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, our instability in chief and where we go from here. And welcome, you know, Dr. Brandi, our good friend Propane Jane. Jane, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back.
So does he fail every criterion of a basic mental capacity evaluation?
I think so, and I've said so.
For the entire two and a half years you've been here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to professionals, and many of us have spoken out, some anonymously, many not anonymously. It hasn't made any difference, unfortunately, but the signs have been pretty glaring from day one.
Yeah. No, I mean, I wanted to give you the props. I mean, you know, inauguration day, you were saying this back then, so I wanted to make sure that you got the juice and the credit you deserve on this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that it's gone on this long, despite the warnings, just goes to show that, again, when you're dealing with somebody who's very narcissistic and sociopathic, that there are people who latch on to that, and they like those qualities to the extent that even though they recognize, hey, this is a person who is very rude, this is a person who's very corrupt, who lies a lot, they actually like that about that person. And so it's not something that's going to turn them away or make them see that person as evil. I mean, evil really is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. And sadly, sadly, a lot of the folks on the right, you know, evil seems to be what draws them. Mm-hmm. And I look at this this story just the other day, and I'm not going to say the guy's name because I don't, as a matter of practice, mention the name of any idiot, murderer, whatever. But the guy who was driving the car in Charlottesville, and killed this young woman, Heather Heyer, and injured many others, in court, found he's guilty. He's pleading for mercy. Uh-huh. And I asked the question, you know, does he deserve mercy? Because he's asking for, you know, less than a life sentence. And the argument is that, well, you know, he suffers from mental illness. And as the prosecutors say, you know, he may have a history of mental illness, but it doesn't excuse his behavior, this kind of hateful behavior. I'm curious, you as a psychiatrist, you know, as a liberal activist, as an African American, does this guy who is deplorable on so many levels, does he deserve mercy?
I think he deserves the same amount of mercy that he showed for Heather Heyer and the protesters that he ran down. He didn't show any mercy to them. And so the audacity of this man to expect that he can just ask for it and get it, I think, is pretty emblematic of the problem we're discussing here. Aside from that, I think a psychiatrist will be the first person to tell you that mental illness isn't an excuse for bad actions. We don't, you know, teach our patients that they should use their mental illness as an excuse for things they do in life. We still expect people to be held accountable.
Right.
And there's nothing to say that whatever his mental illness was, that he didn't have the ability to know right from wrong. And I think in this situation, you know, he's trying to appeal to people who will try to see him as, you know, good people on the other side, fine people on both sides, and identify with him in some personal way, and take mercy on him. And it may work. I mean, we see it happening with Trump every day.
Yeah.
So
I'm not a death penalty person. I don't believe that. I don't believe
I'm
in the death
either.
Penalty. And I've said this before. I don't believe in state sponsored murder, but I do understand vigilante justice.
Uh-huh.
I'm not promoting it, so don't hold me to that. But I understand it. But I'm completely against state sponsored murder. But this is a guy who should never see the light of day again.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, this is somebody who's a sociopath, and that behavior is very hard to change, particularly when it's rooted in a hatred and a bigoted belief system that causes people to think that other people are less than and subhuman in some instances, and so therefore they can just be exterminated.
Right.
And so I think when you have that belief system, you're dangerous to the public, period. I think he's also not necessarily safe in prison. I mean, maybe the Nazis will take him in.
Oh, he's going to be a hero in prison. He's going to be a Nazi hero.
And he'll get protection, you know, from that standpoint. So, I mean, he may actually be safer locked up than he is out free.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the comments on the Facebook page and a lot of the comments I've gotten from people are interesting. You know, a lot of people, you know, rot you know where, which
yeah.
I understand. But for some conservatives saying, you know, he deserves, you know, some bit of leniency and all of this. And my response back was, if he were a black guy who did this, we would have already fried him by now.
Yeah, they wouldn't even be making that plea and that argument at all. And again, like I said, evil is in the eye of the beholder. And what is forgivable, I think, is also in the eye of the beholder.
Now, if he showed remorse, I mean, you know, because evidently the prosecutors are saying he showed absolutely no remorse, would that make a difference?
I think it would. I mean, I think if somebody demonstrates an ability to understand where they've gone wrong, and then you have some feeling like, okay, maybe there's a likelihood that they won't do this again. But if they're not saying anything that indicates any level of remorse, then again, we're going back to sociopathy. We're going back to somebody who's still in his own mind making a justification as to why he was justified in doing the thing that he did. And I think that's what's dangerous about giving somebody like that mercy and setting that example of, you know, we're not actually metering out a sentence that would be commensurate. I mean, there's some people that are life in prison for drug offenses. Not yeah. that's acceptable. but the way that the justice system hands out these sentences, they're still doing that. So why not do that for somebody who did what he did?
Now, I also find some of the rights arguments ironic because, you know, again, I'm not a death penalty person, but a lot of people I know are. We're making the leniency argument, and I'm going, but, you know, wouldn't your argument of using the death penalty be a deterrent to future neo-Nazis who decide to drive their car into a crowd?
Mm-hmm. And also their fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible. Wouldn't that say eye for an eye?
Oh, well, there's the other part. I forgot all about that.
It doesn't work as well when it's somebody that's, you know, one of those fine people.
Yeah, and again, I will never mention his name or any of their names because I just don't, I don't think it's worth it. Let's move on. Evidently, interesting, this week going to be the big debates. Joe Biden on the hot seat. I came across this interesting Club for Growth push poll.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, they did some polling in, I think it was Nevada, Iowa, South Carolina, and New Hampshire. You know, states that are going to weigh heavily in the primary. And
right.
The messaging that they came out with, really, really interesting to me, that they're pushing that he's old. they're pushing that he's anti-woman and that he's a racist. And look, I look at this and I'm going, this is where they're really pushing all their energy. And I'm curious your thoughts of Biden.
He's old. Really,
he's anti-woman and he's a racist.
Before I even say that, that's the Republican talking point?
The Club for Growth talking points.
To other Republicans.
To everybody, that's basically what they're saying, is the messaging that they want to put out.
I mean, I don't even think that's convincing to their own audience. I mean, while they're again tolerating the racist, rapist Trump, so again, I mean, if it, you know, in their mind, they're thinking, okay, Biden's the one we really need to worry about. He's the one that polls the best. Head-to-head against Trump, and we need to take him down. We need to make sure that we don't lose Republican voters to the Democratic Party and Joe Biden. I'm not really sure how you make that argument with people who are A-okay with Trump's racism and Trump's sexual predator everything. I mean, I think they're out of idea. I mean, I don't think they have anything good for anybody.
Oh, no, there's nothing good for Trump in this. All you can do is tear the other side apart. which is why I thought it was interesting that they're going after Biden this way. And look, there's some fair critique of Biden's past. There's some fair, you know, some fair points, especially recently with him, you know, saying nice things about segregationists. And look, I understand what he meant to say.
Yeah.
That you do have to sometimes in the halls of power deal with people you find despicable. I get that.
Right.
I just don't know that it was the smart thing to say how he said it.
No, I don't think it was smart at all. I mean, in particular, the piece about he didn't call me boy. And it's like, come on, Joe. You got to understand just the basic, like, what goes on here with racism and what goes on with bigotry. And that you were afforded a certain privilege as a white man, that he wasn't calling you boy in the same way that men of that era were calling grown adult black men. So I'm not really sure how much of that he understands. I think in particular, you know, this is an issue that is, at least from what I can tell on Twitter, is resonating differently. Certainly with black voters than it is with white voters.
Right.
You know, the commentary I hear from a lot of white voters is like, okay, you know, why are we focusing on Trump? Why are we focusing on Biden and some, you know, sort of inartful comments that he made when really Trump is the actual racist? And I think the black response is, okay, we're not necessarily calling Joe Biden a racist. We are saying that these comments make it seem like he has a blind spot on race issues, in particular when, you know, they're having a hearing about reparations. And then, you know, the first thing that is coming to your mind about these segregationists is that you were able to be civil with them and get certain things done. I don't think that's a good look for him, because I think when you start digging through his past and as much time as he has spent in government and you look at legislation that he's, you know, been a part of, not even just the crime bill, but going back to anti-busing legislation. Some of those things that white voters and black voters who have come to sort of affectionately view Joe Biden in the context of his vice presidency to the first black president may learn some new things about him that they didn't necessarily know. And he may be asked in these debate settings on all of these, you know, media tours to address those issues. And again, if he's going to continue to be inartful, he's really on shaky ground, because I think he has the potential to really put his foot in his mouth.
Yeah, because I look at this as, you know, and the reason I brought it up in the context of the Club for Growth pushing this is it's really about, and look, Biden is not my first choice.
Yeah.
But if it's Biden or Trump, obviously Biden is my first choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look at this stuff and it's really about destroying any support that Biden may have in the African-American community because of his tie to Obama.
Right, right. And I think that at least what we've learned from the 2016 election and the information we have about the cyber attack that came from Russia and also the Republicans, so much of that propaganda was aimed at black voters and was aimed at sort of not only taking their votes away from Hillary, but just having them just completely sit out the process, not necessarily to completely bring them over to the Trump side, but to make them apathetic and distrustful of the candidate that
right.
was, you know, the nominee for the Democratic Party. But what we see over and over again is that black voters are very savvy. And if the messenger is going to be the Republican Party saying this, I mean, it's pretty obvious to us where they stand. This
right.
is why we don't vote Republican. So,
I mean, it won't be the Republicans
trick us at the last minute that somehow we can't tell when people are speaking to us what they're actually saying and be able to, you know, tell what's truth and what's fiction.
Yeah, but you know, it won't be the Republicans saying it. It'll be, you know, dogs and puppies for reparations, or you know, some euphemistically named group that will grab someone's attention, some market tested focus group, approved group that they'll use as a messaging vehicle, because it's what they do. And it's why I think it's important to have these conversations, and why it's important to bring this up. And look, they dug up an interview he did in 1975, which is getting tons of play in the corporate media world. mm-hmm. Where he was against busing. Well, guess what?
Right.
I was against busing because I was a kid at the time when we were sending poor kids from one side of the city of Cleveland to another, and I was living in an all-black neighborhood. And guess who else was against busing? All of the black kids that had to get on those damn buses at 5 o'clock in the morning and be bused all the way across the other side of Cleveland so we could just shuffle people around instead of shuffling around the resources to make sure we all had a chance of getting a decent education. I was 100% against busing.
Right, right. And I think that what we'll see in terms of these issues playing out is a split, particularly with black voters, because we're already seeing that, where you have sort of the baby boomer generation and older generations that may have a certain perspective about these events from history than the younger generation.
Right.
You know, I didn't live through busing. You know, my perspective as somebody that was born in 1981 is, okay, I'm glad they did all of that stuff so that now I go to, you know, integrated school and it's like a fact of life and a fact of reality. And sort of this understanding that, hey, it may not have been that great in the implementation, early implementation phases, and people may not have liked it. But ultimately, those were steps that had to be taken to integrate American society.
Yeah, but we still haven't done that. I mean, you know, it's one thing, you know, we're back to segregated schools like we were before. I mean, you go to places like Cleveland, you know, the Cleveland School District is mostly black kids because that's
right.
Who lives in these areas. I mean,
it's been resegregated.
But it's all economic. I mean, it comes down to, you know, I go back to, you know, why shuffle this stuff around when we should really be focusing on economics? We should be really focusing on getting people jobs and getting them access to the ability to move into areas where you have better schools. And not just that, but also strengthening the schools you have instead of all of these silver bullet options. As someone who doesn't believe in charter schools, because so much of the money is drained off into corporate pockets, why can't we just invest heavily into those school districts and get them the resources and all of the wraparound services that nobody ever wants to talk about that they need?
Well, because that would mean actually prioritizing funding.
And this is where I'm in favor of reparations in the view that we use that money to strengthen those communities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a handout person.
Right.
So I'm not here's a check. I've always been against welfare handout programs, especially as a kid having to go to the store and hand in clown paper money to get something. I believe in jobs programs. I believe in opportunities. And if the private sector can't or won't create enough jobs, the public sector should. But, you know, and this is where, again, on the reparations argument, we should be investing heavily in these institutions that have been just allowed to degrade.
Right, right. No, I totally agree with you there. But I think kind of what's underpinning a lot of this is that sort of anthropological tribalism piece, and people ultimately still naturally segregating
sure.
themselves. And so much of the divestment we see, not just from public education, but also the public health system, is really wrapped in this idea of people not wanting to share with people they hate and
yeah.
people they don't care about.
No, it's an excellent point. Let me ask you a question on that then. Because when we had done our civil rights tour a couple years back, we ended up in Jackson, Mississippi, where the guy who was the head of the NAACP there, Frank Figures, took us around to this street where he said this was the heart of the black middle class.
Mm-hmm.
They had bankers and lawyers, and they had everything you could possibly. This was their middle class. This was their, this is how their community thrived around. In fact, they went to the Masons Hall, where, you know, all of the popular black, you know, singers and people came, and there were thousands of people who showed up. It was the way he told the story was, and maybe it's a bit romanticized, but before desegregation happened, you had a thriving middle class. You had thriving industries that were black only, and he seemed to be pushing the idea that maybe separate but equal is somewhat acceptable.
Yeah, I've heard that argument a lot. I mean, that was obviously a big crux of Malcolm X's argument back in the day, was people not necessarily trying to integrate and actually trying to just strengthen their own selves within their own community. And I think that there are certainly like pockets in you know, across America where that actually does happen. And then, you know, people venture in whenever they want to, you know, like, for instance, all these Chinatowns that are in various places.
Right.
And people venture in because they want to be a part of that culture, even if it's just momentarily. But I think that even as we've done that, there's been so much backlash to the demographic change and to the diversity that in a lot of ways people are not just drawing to themselves sort of for the economic piece of it, but for safety. And not
but that's how it's always been. I mean,
yeah.
that's never changed. When I was a kid growing up in the 70s in Cleveland, and I can only talk about my experience, Cleveland was a heavily segregated city. You know, if you went into Little Italy or Slavic Village or you were on the east side, it was the African-American communities. If you went, you know, down, you know, the West 25th area, it was where the Southerners were, which is now all Muslim now. You had all of these different pockets, and you better not be caught after dark in any of those
right.
pocketed areas.
Yeah.
Because they knew everybody. They were tight-knit communities.
Right.
And you know, those folks now, they that I know that still live in Cleveland, you know, they talk about how, you know, the neighborhoods were safer because we didn't have all this diversity. And there's this pining for what was. And, mm-hmm. and I wonder how much of it is we just romanticize because we truly don't want to be integrated.
Yeah, I think people do romanticize it, or they romanticize it because they, you know, whatever group they belong to wasn't on the short end of the stick in that period. And I think that, you know, even with sort of the backlash that comes, it really ultimately is better when communities are more diverse and people sort of have that choice to pick and choose from what they have. I mean, my county in Fort Bend County, in Sugar Land, Texas, is one of the most diverse counties in America. And part of that is that, you know, the percentages of, you know, Black Americans and White Americans and Latino Americans, you know, it's such a robust mix that it's not this standard 60% white, 12% Black, 13% Hispanic. And it's also like the number four happiest county to live in America.
Yeah, but what's the economic situation? What kind of poverty levels are you talking about?
We're talking about very low poverty.
And to me, that's the key.
Yeah, we're talking about very low poverty. I'll actually send you the article. I tweeted it out the other day, just so happened to. And I do think that particularly when you're talking about immigrant communities, a lot of the community where I live has a lot of people who are medical professionals, doctors, nurses, you name it, and how much we actually do benefit from foreign medical graduates. And when you have policies like the Muslim ban and all of these really racist immigration laws, we really do lose out socioeconomically as a country, not just in these little small pockets of America. And I think a lot of the pieces that were economically anxious, quote unquote, in the last election are in these places that are not only divested of like public money, but also diversity. A lot of these places that are turning red that we're really worried about losing, and so therefore we're chasing this elusive white working class voter, a lot of that is because in the Northeast, a lot of these places, those places have become inhospitable in a lot of ways to people of color. They're highly segregated. There's a police state, literally, like if you think about Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so you see a lot of those people actually moving back to the South and where it's not as segregated. And so it's an interesting migration, I think, that's actually happening across the nation. We're not going to necessarily get good tabs on it because they're, you know, fabricating the census now. but I think that people are actually moving in patterns. And so I think that is changing the way that the elections are running. And we can't necessarily rely on the playbook that we used to.
Yeah, good point. Now let's get to what I wanted to really talk to you about.
Is it instability and cheating?
No, it's Wednesday and Thursday.
Oh, okay.
the real quick, what are our thoughts on the debates?
I wish that, like, how many people are going to be on the stage?
1,700. might as well be. And you know, look, 3/4 of them don't belong there. But yeah, anyway.
What I was just about to say was I wish that however many people are on the stage, that it were like half of that. Because I feel like it's going to kind of be a circus.
Yep.
And nobody's going to have enough time to really flesh out a good answer to the questions that are being asked.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's, hi, my name is such and such, my website is this, tip your waitress, thanks for coming. You know, that's going to be about it. And I say this all the time, but my idea was the best March Madness scenario with brackets and, you know, and voting and all kinds of stuff, one-on-one debates. That would have been the best solution.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just anxious to get to, like, the meat of the sandwich.
Right.
But I do think that in this early stage, it really is most important for just the name recognition factor, just for the faces that are out there to be seen. I think it'll be optically a good thing for people to see, like, hey, this is how many people we have, this is what they have to offer, this is their name. You know, because a lot of these polls, I think, at this stage are really picking up on just who knows this person, who knows their name, who even knows, you know, what they do. I think half of the people that are being polled about, nobody knows about these people. Unless you're a politics junkie like us.
Yeah, I mean, on Wednesday night, there's only one contender, and that's going to be Warren. I don't see O'Rourke having a snowball's chance. Booker certainly doesn't have a chance. Klobuchar, she's got a lot of the slave driver stuff, and then you go down from there of, you know, good luck. I don't even remember John Delaney, the representative from Maryland, and Tulsi.
Wednesday.
Yeah, Wednesday. And Tulsi Gabbard were their vegan cupcakes. Get out of here.
Stop it. No. No, ma'am.
So, you know, there's that. I mean, on the other side, Thursday, you're going to at least have, you know, Biden, Sanders, Harris, and Buttigieg. But then again, you go, there's a major cliff dive from there to Gildebrand, Bennett, and Hickenlooper. And you go, go run for governor or Senate. Oh, that's right. You're governors and senators. Stay there.
I want to know what the ratings difference will be between Wednesday and Thursday.
See, for me, Wednesday is the more important day, I think. Only because I think everybody is going to go after Warren, and it's going to be interesting to me to see how she weathers that storm. Because my only knock against her is I don't think she's going to be able to weather the Trump storm.
Uh-huh.
But if on Wednesday night she can take it and give it back, you know, then, you know, maybe I go, because I like her the best policy wise, because she's got thousands of things that she's written
right.
Everything down.
Right, right. No, I agree with you. My worry with Warren is that when I see her toe to toe with Trump, the matchup, I think personality and demeanor wise. And because they already have this history of him calling her names and,
yep.
You know, I worry that she will be painted automatically as weak in comparison.
Yep. We're on the same page.
Yeah. And again, I love Elizabeth Warren. I mean, but I just feel like I know who we're dealing with. I know what media I know, but her emails.
Yep.
You know, I know who these people are and what they've done and what they've said and how they brought us this disaster that we're standing in right now. And so I don't necessarily like what I see them doing to her.
So if not her, then are we closing in on somebody we like? Who do we think is going to win each night? And are we pulling for anybody?
I don't think there's going to be a winner.
No winners.
No, I think
somebody's going to go viral. I think someone's going to get some pop out of this.
Yeah, I think there will be some good sound bites to take away. But I think that until it gets narrowed down to at least five or six people, that people don't have the attention span, and instability in chief is such a tornado of tumult.
Yep.
Every single day. I mean, every single day there's like, he starts a war, he's accused of rape, he's running concentration camp. I mean, you know what I'm saying? There's
and
so
that was just a Friday. That was just Friday.
There's so many things put into one moment that even these moments that are big sound bites for the Democratic candidates, I think, are just kind of getting lost in the whirlwind.
So we haven't decided on who we're supporting them.
No, we're going to tune in. We're going to watch, and we're going to support them. And we're just going to be proud of our binge.
All right.
I think.
Good
yeah.
stuff. And we can talk about this on Monday, the winner, the loser, and who may have come out of it. Good stuff.
Yeah.
As
okay.
always, Propane Jane, I love having you on. I love your thoughts. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Have a great week.
Good stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.